When you think about all the documentaries that they show on the Nazis, when was the last time you actually saw one dealing with the issue of gun control laws in the Third Reich or just before it? Well, there's a new book out called Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State. And our guest right now is Stephen Holbrook, who is the author of that. He's actually argued some Second Amendment cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he joins us now. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jerry. Glad to be on the show.
Sure. Now, I understand that there were some new documents that have recently or relatively recently come to light that shed new light on this whole issue of the Third Reich and gun control. And boy, you never hear that particular angle, do you?
No, you don't. We had to dig very deep, and it took years to find these documents. Many of them were originally marked secret because they were Gestapo documents or other types of documents that were only Nazi officials had privy to. And they've just been collecting dust in archives in Germany. No historians ever used them. It's always amazed me, and that was my basic incentive to write the book, that out of all the thousands of books on the Third Reich and Nazi Germany, there's no book that even so much as mentioned the gun prohibition policy and the way that gun laws were used against political enemies and the Jewish people.
But isn't it, your book points out that actually the laws themselves or the registration of the guns and so forth, that all occurred prior to the Nazis taking over, correct?
That's right. The Weimar Republic did two things that really made things much worse and made it much easier for the Nazis to consolidate power. One of those things was to pass a law that allowed the executive branch to rule by decree in so-called emergencies.
Oh.
And the other thing was to pass licensing and registration requirements applicable to gun owners so that they knew who the gun owners were, at least the ones who were legal who volunteered to register. And in fact, the Weimar officials even warned, do not let these records fall into the wrong hands, the hands of radical elements. And that was in 1931. And of course, in 1933, the radical elements took power. And they immediately used those registration records to confiscate guns, to cancel gun licenses of social democrats and others who were their political enemies. They went on to abolish competing political parties. All of the non-Nazi parties were abolished. And then in 1938, they disarmed the Jewish people using the same registration records in the weeks before the Night of the Broken Glass or Kristallnacht.
Isn't that interesting? In fact, you opened up the book talking about a hero of Germany who happened to be Jewish, and he was an Olympic athlete who had won in a previous time, not the 1936 one. But anyway, and this was a Jewish man, and he owned a firearm, totally legal, and he registered when his government asked him to register that. The Nazis used it against him. He ends up in a concentration camp, and boom, he dies shortly thereafter.
Yeah, he exemplifies the whole history of this subject. His name was Alfred Platov. He won gold for Germany in the 1896 Olympics in gymnastics. In 1932, he registered three handguns, according to the decree of the Weimar Republic. And the next thing we know, we fast forward to 1938, and it's in October of 38, and there he is in a Berlin police station turning in his guns. The record of the arrest said that he had registered those guns. They identified the police station where he registered them back in 1932. And then it said that guns and the Jews are a danger to public safety, a ridiculous statement. There was not even a law at that time against Jews possessing a gun. And, of course, then he was turned over to the Gestapo, and another Jewish gun owner in line behind him turned his guns in. And then before we know it, just three or four weeks later, you have the massive attacks known as Kristallnacht, where synagogues were burned, houses were broken into, residents terrorized, Jewish stores were vandalized, 20,000 Jewish men were put in concentration camps. then that was basically what has been called the beginning of the Holocaust. And then we fast forward four more years, and we have Flatow being ordered to board a transport train to deport him to the Theresienstadt concentration camp, where he quickly died. So that tells the whole story of what happened just through the eyes of one man.
So in other words, the first thing they did before the Nazis even took power, you had the registration of the firearms by the state. And then what happened when the Nazis took power, they had to register. But the Kristallnacht did not happen until the Nazis had the guns away from the Jewish people. Is that basically the gist of it as far as Kristallnacht?
Yes, that's right. And what's fantastic, there's a number of studies and books on Kristallnacht, but none of them go into the disarming policy. And that's the surest indication that the attacks were being planned in advance.
Yeah.
They didn't just go out to disarm them when they had not done so before for no reason. And once they were totally disarmed, then you could attack them. And the Nazi thugs who committed these attacks had no fear of resistance, self-defense, or retribution. And then, as I said, it was not even illegal for Jews to have guns up until that time. And then when these attacks started and they were in full sway, the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, decreed that a Jew with a gun would get 20 years in a concentration camp.
Wow. Okay, now, when Nazi Germany took over other countries such as the Netherlands or Norway and so forth, could the people, let's say the people of Norway, all right, they had guns prior to that. What happens, you know, when the Nazis took over? And by the way, my wife is from Norway, and I asked her when I was looking at your book, I said, you know, during the war, was it legal for a Norwegian to have a gun? And she said, of course not. By the way, it was illegal for a Norwegian to have a radio that could, you know, pick up shortwave so they could find out what was really going on in the war and not just get the propaganda on the AM radio, you know, from the Nazis taking over Norway, but kind of the satellite countries.
Yeah, here's what took place in every single country that they invaded and occupied. They immediately put up posters in every village, every city, that you had to turn in all your guns and radio transmitters within 24 hours or you were subject to being executed. And there were a lot of people who were indeed executed. I've got a little bit of material on that at the end of this book, and I'm doing further studies on that now.
Wow.
But it's actually in the German newsreels. There's one from 1940 when they're invading Holland, Netherlands,
yes.
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands is Holland, of course.
Right.
So
and it actually shows them nailing up one of these posters to the wall. And then it shows a close-up of it, and it says exactly what I just told you, that you have to turn in your guns and radio transmitters within 24 hours or you're going to be shot.
You know, by the way, that reminds me, now that you mention this, I was talking to a man who grew up in Holland, and by the way, his family, he said he and his brother were playing. This was a pastor in America, I mean, jumping forward years later. But anyway, when he was a child growing up in Holland, he and his brother were playing up in the attic, and they came running down. They said, Mom, did you know there's a little old lady up there? There was. It was a Jew that they were hiding, but they were keeping that from the children. But anyway, he said that one of his, one of his fellow students at school had told the authorities, you know, the teacher or whatever, that their dad at home had a gun. And to make an example out of the Nazis shot that guy, you know, in front of his family and everything. They shot the father who owned the gun. So it was just absolutely amazing. But this gun control factor is just one you never hear about.
Right, and I have to relate two more items because you raised it. In Norway, there was some resistance by civilians.
Oh, yeah.
The armed forces were quickly defeated, but there were actually guys who had been competitors in shooting matches, and they knocked off a lot of the Germans, and the resistance continued there. And there were instances in Holland where there was a lady who was hiding Jews, and some kind of official came to, it was discovered, they came to take this Jew away, and she actually shot the guy who came. And she actually lived to tell the tale, and she ended up immigrating to the U.S. She only died a few years ago in Vermont.
Wow.
So this kind of thing happened, and there was resistance, and the Nazis, of course, were cognizant of there were a number of people who did not turn in their guns despite the death penalty threat.
Yeah.
And that was always a factor of uncertainty that made them have to use up more energy in their occupation policy.
Yeah.
So it was actually a good thing that people didn't turn them in. They were able, in some cases, to resist, and in other cases, just to add to the uncertainty.
Just as a quick aside, I'm a connoisseur of museums. I love museums. And my favorite museum in the whole world is in Oslo, which is where my wife is from, and I was married there and so forth. But anyway, there's a museum dedicated to the resistance movement during World War II. And it's absolutely fascinating, and it deals with this, that kind of stuff, and the brave Norwegians who managed to get the heavy water out of the hands of Hitler, which was being developed in a place called Telemark, where Hitler really could have actually had a type of nuclear bomb before the Americans did, if it weren't for those brave Norwegian soldiers. And they weren't even soldiers. They were more like lay people, lay men that went out and skied and managed to do the sabotage. But anyway, we have just a few minutes left. What are your thoughts then when you hear liberals today? Not that we want to call anybody Nazis or anything like that, and we don't. But what are your thoughts when you hear about those who are advocating for gun control laws, and they want strict registration and, you know, strict this and strict that related to gun control laws? And they seem to forget that, hey, the people that are law-abiding are going to follow all the laws, right?
That's exactly what happened in Weimar Republic, Germany. There was a lot of violence, to be sure. The communists and the Nazis were fighting each other in the streets and beating up people and shooting them. And so the fallacy was in thinking that, well, why don't we pass laws that register and license gun owners? Well, only law-abiding ones are going to obey that. And that's the same problem today when we have various prohibitions and attempts to criminalize gun ownership, basically, that only law-abiding people go by that, and it doesn't do any good. And in fact, there are indications historically why we should be very careful what we wish for, because it's always possible to misuse this kind of information. It might be misused by the government itself or by people who basically hack into those kinds of records.
Wow.
I mean, we've seen this massive surveillance of the American public by the government. People are shocked at what's happening, you know, with the internet surveillance and cell phones and all of that.
Yeah.
The technology that's possible. We have a national criminal background check system that screens gun buyers when they buy guns from federally licensed gun dealers. The records have to be destroyed within 24 hours. That's a safety feature of that, but it's certainly possible to collect records and to misuse them for political purposes or otherwise.
If you were to look at a map, let's say, of Europe, around 1940 or 41, 40, let's say 1941. Okay, so you look at this map of Europe and you see, hey, there's this one country there about in the middle there that's not allied with the ally or the Axis. It's Switzerland. Okay, now, is there any correlation to the fact that Switzerland, which was neutral, the fact that most of those people would own guns, that the Nazis never tried to take over Switzerland?
If I could just make a plug, I have two books, Target,
yes,
Switzerland and the Swiss and the Nazis, that go into great detail about that.
Oh.
And it's a matter of fact that then, as well as now, and going back centuries, the Swiss have had a militia army in which all males are required to have arms and to keep them at home. And that played right into that gave a great disincentive to the Germans to think about invading Switzerland. You know, they could get at France in one or two ways, the northerly route through Belgium and Luxembourg and Holland, or the southerly route through Switzerland. And they chose to go the northerly route because you had quite a different situation. I mean, with Switzerland, you had every man being armed and they could be mobilized immediately. And you had terrain in which the Luftwaffe and the Panzers couldn't be very effective. So through the war. You've got that wonderful little white spot in the middle of the Third Reich, which was extending all the way into Russia and North Africa and all of Europe, just about. Right. And it was basically a beacon of democracy.
Wow. All right, independent.org for more information. The name of the book, Gun Control in the Third Reich. The author is the man who's been our guest for this segment, Stephen Hallbrook, that's spelled H-A-L-B-R-O-O-K. We're out of time. Thanks so much, Stephen. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
All right.